Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're back now with our live coverage of the 118th running of the Boston Marathon. This year, the men's race was won by American men, Meb Keflezighi. He's the first American man to win the Boston Marathon since 1983. Today, on his bib, he had the names of the four people who died in last year's marathon bombing and the manhunt that followed. On his bib, written in the markers in the corners, were the names of Crystal, Lindsay, Martin, and Sean. Just one of the many ways in which the meaning of today was communicated by the 36,000 runners on the race. Here's a little bit more from Meb Keflezighi himself.
I'm blessed to be an American, and God bless America, and God bless Boston. This is a special day on Patriots Day, and, you know, it happens in God's time. I tried it, but it cannot be a better day than this day.
Meb Keflezighi, the winner, the men's winner of today's Boston Marathon. On the women's side, Rita Jeptu of Kenya won for the second year in a row, her third total Boston win. Now, among those running today, three people who met amidst the chaos of last year's bombing.
Carol Downing ran in last year's race. Two of her daughters, Erica and Nicole, and her son-in-law, Michael, were injured in the explosions. Erica was severely injured.
Because of the day's events, Carol's path would intersect with that of Tim Island, another marathon runner, and his wife, Patty. After the bombs went off, the South End couple took Carol in, and the three have been close friends ever since.
They told us their story, beginning with Carol Downing.
The race wasn't going exactly how I had planned. I had to stop and fix my shoelace. And so my back started hurting because I was wearing a belt on my back with some goo, which I never did when I was training.
And here's Tim Island, who was also having a tough race.
Training couldn't have gone better for me. And that, I think, sometimes occurs where than the race day, you're having a challenging race day. At mile 8, I could tell my legs just didn't have it.
It was strange because I usually don't run with music, but I had my iPhone and I was listening to music and it was stuck on the same song over and over and over and over again. It's a song by Matt Nathanson called All We Are. And when I go back and I listen to the words, they're just really profound because we are all in a different place than we are right now. And that's all we are, you know. So it was, I think it was a song that was meant to be stuck on my playlist.
Every day's a start, something beautiful.
And Tim's wife, Patty, who was among the spectators waiting for her husband to finish.
I was standing at Commonwealth Avenue at Hereford and waiting for Tim to run up underneath Mass Avenue. Then I heard the explosions. And everybody sort of turned in that direction. It seemed like policemen came out of nowhere. Just seemed like hundreds of policemen came out and stopped the runners, and then all the chaos ensued.
So I made it underneath the Mass Ave Bridge, and I was just about to turn right onto Hereford when we were stopped.
All of a sudden, there was a wall of people, just runners stopped.
Didn't know what was occurring, but quickly my friend pulled up. He had his phone, and he pulled up on Twitter. He said this is terrorism, and there were explosions at the finish line.
And then Tim texted right back, and serendipitously, we were right there within 50 yards of each other, and we were able to connect within minutes.
I was trying to text my daughters, and I wasn't getting any answer. And then finally, my son-in-law sent me a text, and I had to have the guy next to me read it. He said, Nicole's on her way to Brigham and Women's Hospital. I think I came up Hereford Street and I looked and saw the sidewalk just full of blood, and that's when I realized this is bad. So then the guy who was helping me realized it was more of a crisis situation.
We walked down to the Pru to try to get to the Dana-Farber post-race headquarters to check in to say we were okay.
And he took me to the Prudential building and we opened up the door and Tim and Patty were like standing there on the steps as if they were waiting for me.
This gentleman walks up with kind of Carol on his shoulder.
And he went up to them and he said, do you know if this T-stop will take her to the hospital. Her daughters were injured in the bombing.
I said, we live blocks from here. We're from Boston. We know where the hospital is. Come with us, and we'll take care of you. And so off we went.
This is really strange. I'm walking somewhere, people, I have no idea who they are, and I just kind of felt like I was following them along like a little lost dog. And we went to their place, and
I immediately went to the kitchen, pulled some bagels and peanut butter and bananas, and offered them up. And at first, Carol wasn't interested in eating. I think Tim ate a little bit.
I remember that you asked me, I don't know, 3 or 4 times, do you want to take a shower? And I was like, yeah. And then it was a little later, do you want to take a shower? Oh, yeah, I want to take a shower.
And I remember thinking she was in shock because she was just so functional and so rational given the circumstances.
Patty says she offered me some clean clothes, but that just totally went over my head. So I had showered at their house and put my running clothes back on.
I thought, really? Okay.
All I asked for was a jacket, a phone charger.
Reading glasses.
And I said, I promise I'll get you this stuff back. And they're like, no, don't worry about it. Don't worry. I said, I'll get it back to you. But that's all I needed.
You know, I do remember, like, trying to sort of draw that right balance of kind of being helpful but not kind of just letting her, you know, so I didn't want to push anything on her.
I don't accept help too easily, but I'm learning. So it was kind of like I'm just like, no, I'm okay. I don't need clothes. You don't have to stay. But I'm glad they did. Patty went and got us some soup and some coffee, and they left when my son-in-law's brother got there.
As we were leaving at somewhat 8 o'clock, that's when we started processing. What has just gone on?
And I still didn't know where Erica was. I kept asking, you know, does anybody know, have any information on Erica? And so the FBI agents finally found out where she was for me, and I got to see her at 9 o'clock that evening, and she was already out of surgery. And I went in and I looked at her and she was puffy and she had a breathing tube in and her hair was all singed. And I just honestly didn't recognize her at first. I remember just standing there looking at her and thinking, please, dear God, don't let this be her. And then I realized it was her. And the doctor or nurse went in, we went into a room and they told me the extent of her injuries. And I just remember thinking, okay, this is what we're going to deal with.
We didn't get to sleep until 12:30 or 1 a.m., and then we woke up to a text message from Carol about her daughter Erica losing a limb, and that was pretty excruciating.
Devastating.
Yeah. Carol and I were in communication for a bit.
They found housing for me while I was up here through Patty's work. That was wonderful because I was up here for 50 days with Erica. So it was nice to have a place to go back to that was easy to get back and forth to the hospitals but was away from it. And they were close by. They were only, 4 blocks away. So
I was concerned to ask something and break a barrier. And so we would just keep reaching out and, hey, can we take you to dinner or let's go for a walk or and we did a few of those things along the way.
So it was just a great connection for me to know somebody in Boston, you know. And they sent flowers to me on Mother's Day and, you know, just special little touches. And they have loads of pictures that I've sent them of my daughter's progresses, and we're texting all the time.
Most of my text messages you end up deleting and you get rid of your history. And the strings with Carol and Patty and I, that's a string that I can't replace. Yeah. So I can go back and I have the entire string from April 15th.
It's a friendship that'll last. It's really, really special to me.
It was a gift that came out of this horrific event. I mean, it's just, you know, a lifelong friend. Watching the family, all of them, so positive, you know, despite setbacks along the way. And that's been really inspiring to me. It sort of has put things in perspective for me. That's changed me, I think.
I remember one of the things that you said to me right away was, Tim will do anything for anybody. I would just give somebody a $20 bill and tell them to take a cab.
I don't think
you're that way anymore. I'm not making fun of that because I would have been the same. But that's changed me too, because I think of all the times, all the missed times I've had to help people, and I didn't. You know, now I kind of search out of what can I do, how can I help, and it's because of them. I honestly think it was just always meant for us to have met. I really do. You know, just every piece falls into the puzzle for us to be friends.
That's Carol Downing of Maryland, along with Tim and Patty Island of Boston's South End. All three are running the race this year. Tim and Patty are running for Dana-Farber. We've been tracking their progress so far.
And here's where they are. Patty Island is making her way up Heartbreak Hill, nearing the 21-mile mark. Her husband, Tim, and Carol Downing are just approaching mile 25. Carol's daughters are both recovering well from their injuries. They're at the finish line again this year. And you can find more information about their stories at RadioBoston.org.
Well, perhaps the busiest person on this Marathon Monday is Dave McGilvray, the Boston Athletic Association race director. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
It's great to have you. So we spoke with you a couple weeks ago as you were gearing up for the big race today.
Yeah.
And you told us that you've overseen, 26 marathons for the BAA? And this race was going to be different in a lot of ways. 36,000 runners, 10,000 volunteers, 3,500 police and security officers, a million spectators. Wow. How's it gone for you so far?
Way better than we could have ever imagined. You know, I was anticipating some slight little glitches here and there, but, you know, as of right now, in terms of checking with the team, doesn't seem like there were any, if maybe a few, but nothing compared to what, you know, in anyone's mind could have happened given the complexity of this and given the magnitude of what we were dealing with. But I'm just so thrilled and so pleased with the way things have turned out so far.
Right. And we know that the race obviously is not yet over for many, many people who are still making their way across the finish line. We saw you on television a little bit earlier giving Meb Keflezighi, the men's winner, a huge hug after he crossed the finish line. Did you have a chance to talk to him? And what did it mean to you to see an American take the laurel wreath today?
Well, Meb and I are very, very, very close friends. We have been for a number of years, and we were actually out together the other night, and we were walking back. We walked a mile from Kenmore Square to the finish line together, and we were just talking about the race and his strategy and all. And then I was on the lead motorcycle the whole way, and I was next to him the entire way. Just I wasn't saying anything to him because you're not supposed to, but it was just fascinating to see how he was, his strategy and how he took it out. And, you know, the gap was closing near the end, but then he was just digging and digging and digging for anything and everything he had to hang on for the win. And he did. And, you know, it's just so amazing to think that what happened last year and then Boston Strong and then the Red Sox win the World Series, now an American in particular, one of the greatest guys on the planet, Meb Keflezighi, wins the race.
Yeah, I mean, we were watching on television, and it was, I mean, our throats were in our hearts watching him cross over into Kenmore Square, and he was looking like he was starting to feel the effects of, 25 miles at that point in time, and occasionally glancing over his shoulder. But he really did hold on for just a fabulous finish. Now, Dave, for you, a little earlier today at the start line, or I guess I should say a lot earlier today, before the elite men took off, you said that we're taking back our race today, that we're taking back the finish line. What did you mean by that, and do you think that that is what has happened?
Well, I think, you know, obviously given what happened last year, the explosions, and then having to have to, you know, evacuate, and then all the injuries, and you know, so many people were victimized, people didn't finish, just everything bad happened, and we had to go through a period of, you know, processing and healing and recovering, and we did. And we all just felt, you know, we're resilient and we're going to persevere and we're going to overcome this. But we can only do it next year when the race happens. So April 21st comes and this is our chance. And everything has gone so well. It just, even any other year, this would be a home run. And this year, it's just a grand slam.
Mm. Does it feel like the BAA itself has able to start a new chapter in terms of the narrative and the meaning of the Boston Marathon, not just for runners, but for American athletics as a whole?
Yeah, especially with Meb's victory, for sure. This race has always been about the pursuit of athletic excellence. It's always been the holy grail of marathons throughout the world. And that's, we wanted to stay with that game plan for today. And I think we did. I think we showed the world that, you know, we can continue even under adverse conditions. We can continue to put on a high quality world class event. And logistically, operationally, and then you add all the emotions to it and the field size and an extra 9,000 and you add the overall security enhancement. It was a daunting, daunting task at hand. But, I can't see where anyone wouldn't be over the top thrilled with the results so far.
Yeah. Now, Dave, before I let you go, I have to ask, it's been a long and busy day for you so far, but mm-hmm. you're going to do what you do at the end of this day every year, and you're going to run the course tonight. Is that right?
Yeah. In fact, heading back to my hotel room now just to kind of get my stuff together and figure out the game plan and get dressed to head back out. And I'll start somewhere between 6 and 7 tonight and cross the finish line around 11:30-ish, something like that. So it'll be a fun one for me. It's just the calm after the storm. I'm looking forward to this just to sort of decompress a little bit, even though, you know, the challenge of 26.2 on foot is obviously challenging as it is to the 36,000. But for me, it'll be it'd be a welcome change to a long day.
Yeah, and it won't be on a closed course anymore. So,
No. Listeners,
if you see a man sometime between 7 and 11 o'clock tonight running the course of the Boston Marathon, and you think it might be Dave McGillivray, give him a high five or a cheer because he is the race director for the Boston Athletic Association. Dave, thank you so much. Thanks for a wonderful day, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
There you go. Nice example of the admirable qualities of the long-distance runners. Listeners, stay with us. More coverage of Marathon Monday coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.